Okay, that was a nice loud clap. Good morning, good afternoon. I want to call the Special Committee on Military Veterans Affairs to order. It is now 1:21 p.m. on Tuesday, February 22nd. We're in the Gruenberg Room here in the state capitol in Juneau. Present, we have Representative Tarr, Representative Story, Representative Shaw, and Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chair Representative Tuck. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please mute your cell phones. I would like to thank Talia Ames with the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting. And then Lori Rowland, who is with House Records, that's documenting today's meeting online or remotely. And thank you, Representative Klayman, for joining us. We have one item on the agenda today, House Bill 297, sponsored by Representative Greer Hopkins. And with him is Tanya Klukas, here to present the bill to the committee. Please note that today we are going to take up public testimony during this hearing. So welcome, Representative Hopkins. If you will, please go ahead and state your name for the record and tell us about your bill, House Bill 297.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greer Hopkins, representative for House District 4, North Fairbanks, from Esther to Goldstream, downtown Fox, some of the Seas Highway, Birchill, and downtown Fox. With me today, I have my trustee staff member, Tanya Klukas, who will also be going through the slide presentation and available to answer questions. The matter we are here today is an important issue to the state as a whole and military families that are residing in Alaska. I'm privileged to sponsor House Bill 297 as part of the ongoing efforts in the Fairbanks area, as part of our Tiger Team collaborative effort in Fairbanks. We've worked closely with the Department of Defense to make Alaska one of the best places in the nation to conduct defense mission activities here. Currently, there is no requirement for civilian authorities to notify the Department of Defense when a military child is involved in a case involving abuse or neglect. This bill simply puts into statute that when a report of harm to a child who is a military dependent is made to civilian authorities, that the appropriate Department of Defense office will be notified as well. This ensures that families have access to resources specifically for military families, and that the Department of Defense has a local partner for the health and welfare of those it works with. We have before us a way to assist the Department of Defense with providing services to its members, and at the same time, make sure that Alaska continues to be a place where those in the service can continue to live, work, serve, and play in an environment that looks out for all of their needs. At this time, I'll go ahead and pass it off to my staff, Tanya Klukas, to make a brief presentation on the bill, and we are available to answer any questions. And additionally, we have online Ms. Tammy Perot, who is the Department of Defense State Liaison Office, and she's here for invited testimony and has a lot of knowledge that can assist us as well for questions that are above our pay grade.
Okay, and now I'd like to let the record reflect that Representative Nelson has joined us about 1:23. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Ms. Klukas, please put your name and affiliation on the record. Again.
Thank you. This is Tanya Klukas. I'm staff to Representative Greer Hopkins. And just to start off with, before you have the sponsor statement, I'm going to respect your literacy and not read the sponsor statement for you. Also, next, we will have a very brief sectional analysis, which is not provided here. We are inserting a new subsection of Alaska Statute 4713030. To sum it up, it says that if there is harm that concerns a child who is the dependent of a member of the armed forces, that the civilian authorities will inform the appropriate federal authorities about that situation so that it can be addressed within the chain of command. This sums up that part. With that, I would like to begin my presentation. Also, I'd like to note we have a fiscal note that is zero, and additionally that the verbiage on the fiscal note notes that it will have no fiscal or programmatic impact on the Office of Children's Services. Anecdotally, when we were working on this, a number of the professionals that I talked to said that they would look forward to having this sort of statute in place as it would make their jobs within the installations easier.
Okay, real quick, Representative Shaw has a question.
I'm sorry to interrupt Representative Shaw here.
Yes.
I've got House Bill 97 up there, and I've got 297 over here.
Through the chair, Representative Shaw, you know how you can have four people edit a document for you, and every single one of them misses the very obvious absence of a digit? Yes.
I understand the obvious.
So we just noticed it when we sat down.
Thank you.
So, too many cooks. So, so with that, with your forbearance, I'll go ahead and start. So to start off with, the Department of Defense has a Defense State Liaison Office, and they have a number of issues that they look to address with the different states to make sure that the places where DOD has installations are better prepared and better suited for having the military in their state. The Department of Defense today is not the Department of Defense that I grew up with family that's been in the service in the 70s. These days, like 70% of families do not live on base or on post on whichever installation. They are out in their local communities. That means there is a greater expectation of the communities that surround military installations to provide services that historically have been provided on base or on post. So here I pulled from the Defense State Liaison Office the key issues for the state of Alaska and where we're at. As you can see, military spouse licensure, we're getting there. The occupational licensure access, thanks to work that was done last year, we've got there. In-state tuition continuity, the University of Alaska has really a wonderful way of providing tuition support for in-state tuition for people who are military and military affiliated. DEED has achieved the Purple Star program, so we're working with DOT to make sure that we can check these boxes. And it also makes Alaska more attractive to the Department of Defense for continuing to continue the mission here and possibly place further installations. Senator Murkowski mentioned the F-35s to increase what's happening here. So this is part of our motivation to be a good partner and also look out for the best interests of the state of Alaska. So this bill is specifically addressing child abuse identification and reporting. This here is also from the Defense State Liaison Office. You can see a number of states in the union already have passed legislation so that there can be legal reporting back and forth of abuse issues to the chain of command so it can be addressed within there. And we're working to do our part. There are in place some informal MOUs, they're not informal because it would be MOUs, but within municipalities and other organizations, but there is nothing at a statewide level that mandates it to happen, and it's important, and DOD has it out there as one of their requests, and we're working to be a partner to help them. So, some interesting stats that our child population in Alaska, we have about 180,000 people in who are considered children in Alaska, and about 10% of those are military dependents. That's a significant part of Alaska's population. And we have some child abuse stats in our state that are nothing to be proud of. And I believe Representative Rauscher has a question.
Representative Rauscher.
That was good. Thank you, through the chair. So I'm trying to understand the last bullet. Percentage-wise, are we percentage-wise, or are we quantifying to come up with the outpacing numbers?
Which bullet? On this slide, the reported child abuse, or
bullet number three? I thought we were on a different page.
This one there.
Yeah, that one there. Since 2003, the reported child abuse in military families has outpaced reported abuse for civilian population, coinciding with the increased deployments overseas and operations. So when it says we've outpaced, is that percentage-wise? Because I'm assuming there's less people in the military than there are everywhere else. Or are we quantifying?
Yep. To be honest, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, that is an excellent question. I was having some fun reading about child maltreatment in military families. If you like, I can provide this to you, which is where I pulled the information from, where it was for medical providers and that they're seeing more child abuse within military families. I would like to hope that it's it feels like a word, awful word to use when you're describing things like child abuse and maltreatment, but I would make the assumption based that it is within the healthcare community that it is a percentage. Why? So a percentage of the military population based on a percentage of the civilian population.
Follow up? Okay, so then the last part of the sentence here,
mm-hmm.
with increased deployments and overseas operations,
mm-hmm.
Is the majority overseas the problem, or is the majority here?
Through the chair, Representative Rasher, that's not something that I did enough research to be able to answer to you. I could look more into it if you like, but it was mostly I was looking for materials that would be able to state that it is known that there is an increase in child abuse issues and that the Department of Defense has recognized that they have a different service than they had 40 years ago, and that they're looking more to be able to provide services and support to those who are considered part of the force, whether they're actually the enlisted or the families. And that's why in 2019, they had the Family Advocacy Program came along, which was part of the incentive to make this happen.
I appreciate the follow-up.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking for or against anything here. I'm just trying to understand everything. And if you don't have the answers, that's fine. You can provide them later. But looking at the map in the previous slide, I'm just wondering and reading what it has to say. So is this legislation, is it born out of the lower 48 and we're trying to align ourselves with it? Or is there an actual need right here that has superseded this?
Through the chair, Representative Rasher, no, this was a request by the Department of Defense, which is why Ms. Perot with the Department of Defense is online as part of our invited testimony. So she is a Department of Defense employee that works to make sure that the states within her portfolio assignment are aligned with what DOD's mission is and what their expectations are for their both enlisted and their civilian components, people who are their dependents. And so we have been working with the Tiger team out of Fairbanks. I'm the person who sits on it for the representative's office. And they saw an opportunity to get one more thing on their list of policies, statutes, laws that they would like to see in place for the improvement of the lives of the people who are their responsibility. And we said, we'll try to take care of that for you. And that's why we're here.
One last follow-up. And so is the Tiger team seeing an actual real need there in the Fairbanks area, or military bases in the Fairbanks area, or what was it? But what would spark this? This is all I'm trying to figure out.
Through the chair, is our office, it wasn't anything that we saw as a need. We were approached by DOD and asked to carry this. Right. And prior to this legislature, Senator Coghill had this same piece of legislation. And then a pandemic happened, and it didn't really go anywhere. And so we agreed to pick it up and try and advance it on behalf of the Department of Defense.
All righty. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. I just want to point out, I think one of the, going back to that third bullet point, I think the takeaway for me is that is the last part of that sentence that says coincided with increased deployments and overseas operations. And the reason why I bring that up is the Department of Defense uses the parents as teachers model. And one of the nice side effects of parents as teachers is that for those deployed families, or those families with deployed members, they get together once a month with their children. And that has acted as a kind of support group, if you will, for those members, those families that have deployed members. And it's really helpful. As a matter of fact, we had a joint armed services meeting up in Fairbanks that Representative Tarr put together for us. And the Department of Defense at that time also mentioned, they call it Heroes at Home program. And but they talked about the benefits of having those type of programs and supporting our military families. But I think the big takeaway is that it coincides with the increased deployments and overseas operations, because you're actually, when you deploy a member overseas or out of the state, you're actually breaking up families a little bit, and it's hard. And so I appreciate the consideration in this bill. Please continue.
Thank you, sir. And for the record, this is Tanya Klukas with Office of Representative Hopkins. So the important thing here is that it will further require and allow collaboration and coordination of services between the civilian authorities of the state of Alaska and the federal authorities for the different installations in our state. So we have, as a state, we have an authority to look after the health and welfare of our citizens. And the, as I mentioned before, answering questions, the Family Advocacy Program has a requirement that those who are dependents who have been identified as abuse or maltreatment victims, that DOD has the responsibility to look to their treatment, to their rehabilitation, and working with both the victim and the entire family that's involved. So this really is looking at a way to coordinate services and also make sure that those Alaskans who also have a military affiliation don't just have available to them the civilian services that they would otherwise have, but also the Department of Defense services that would be available. And one of the big issues, and this was mentioned on one of the bullet points in the earlier slides, is people don't live strictly on the military installations the way that they did decades before. People are now out in the communities. And so if an incident happens out in the community and it's reported through OCS, the chain of command is not necessarily going to know because it was not reported on base, on post. And so we're trying to make sure that everybody gets the best services available to and they can collaborate and work together instead of in a silo. They can make sure that a wraparound is available for everyone. So this was saying earlier, it's a continuum of care to make sure that all the services that are there, military families especially, because of deployments, because of other special stresses, have things that are relevant to them in their lives and their lifestyle changes, whether it's deployments, PCSs, PTSD that happens within a family. We don't know, but there are special services available within the DOD that can help those families out and help them stay together and help them address their issues. And so we want to also make sure that we keep Alaska in the forefront of the Department of Defense, thinking of us as a place where not just because of our geography that we're a place to have the mission, but also because of what we offer the people who are in the service, that they want to come here with their families and stay behind. On a personal level, it's like my great uncle was stationed in Alaska with the Army Corps during World War II, and he came back, and I have a whole bunch of family on the Kenai Peninsula that I'm pretty sure that if that hadn't happened, thanks to, the Army Corps of Engineers, I wouldn't have them there. So Alaska has a long history of having people who get stationed here and deciding they never want to leave, and we want to make sure that we continue to be the sort of state where that happens. And this is a way we can do it, and we're doing this at the request of the Department of Defense. And with that.
Any further questions, comments? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, this might be directed towards you or to Ms. Perot. Looking at the legislation, the designated authority that this information would go to, mm-hmm. I realize Jay Baird would probably have someone because it's a large enough base. Same with Wainwright or Erickson. But what about smaller installations where, it might just be a team of a few dozen soldiers? How would that kind of work out, having a designated authority without it being the designated authority, is more closely aligned with that person who's getting reported on? And would you be able to answer that for a smaller installation or?
So through the chair for Representative Nelson's. Tanya Klukas, Office of Representative Hopkins. Having spent many years being DOD aligned, I could speculate and feel comfortable, but in this situation, I would need to defer to the expertise of Ms. Perot because this is what she does on the regular, and it's part of her job and her obligation. Okay. I have a pretty good guess, and considering your affiliation with the military, I'm pretty sure you do too, but it is her expertise.
Okay, shall we go ahead and go to invited testimony real quick and let her do her presentation, then we can save that question, if you don't mind, Representative Nelson. Any questions on the bill sponsor, for the bill sponsor, Representative Story?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you for bringing this forward. I think coordination is really important and families get the support they need. So I have a couple of questions. One of them is there any kind of time requirement that the department would need to have to notify the base or about the incident? I was wondering if there was a time.
Through the chair, Representative Story. No, we didn't put anything like that in. That is a excellent point. I mean, just because there's a requirement to notify someone doesn't necessarily mean it's timely, and it's a good thing to think about. And I would certainly hope that it would be considered in the drafting of any sort of MOUs that would come out of this between OCS and other entities and the family liaison offices.
Follow up. Yes, so from reading the PowerPoint, DEED still has the statutory authority to oversee the cases, and so they would notify the department or the base. Mm-hmm. And then my question is, obviously, DEED would still need to follow the case and have the supports. What would the base need to do? And do they report back? How do you see the communication and making sure services are happening to the families?
Through the chair, Representative Story. It has the oversight because usually it's a child abuse. And that, yet again, it's a more technical question than beyond my area of expertise. I did consult with some social workers who I know work with the military as DOD contractors to get their thoughts on this. And they were all for this. And as far as the specifics of how they collaborate with their colleagues across boundaries, we didn't get into that because that's kind of moving into scope of practice, and that would be outside of my scope of practice for a position like this. But we want to hope that they would collaborate together and that this legislation would make it easier for them to collaborate together because they would be able to talk about a situation, whereas in other cases, because of privacy issues, they may or may not be able to. But yet again, I'm starting to speculate, and this is not the right forum for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. With that, I think we'll go ahead and go to invited testimony, unless there's anything more the sponsors would like to add. So I'm going to go ahead and go to invited testimony, and we'll bring in Ms. Perot. Ms. Perot, if you please state your name and affiliation for the record, and please start with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the Military Veterans Affairs Committee, my name is Tammy Perot, and I am the Northwest Region Liaison for the Defense State Liaison Office. It is an honor to be here in front of you today. A special thanks to Representative Hopkins and his staff, Tanya, for bringing this forward. This bill is very important to the Department of Defense because it will assist Alaska in joining 31 other states who have passed similar legislation on this issue in working to prevent child abuse and neglect. The bottom line up front is, particularly for those of you who may not be as familiar with the military way of life, is that unlike civilian employers, the military services have the obligation to know what's happening with our military members. It's part of how we do business. And being a military member is not just a 9-to-5 job. We have special care and consideration for our military families. Information sharing between the Department of Defense and local authorities must be accomplished at the start of an abuse or neglect investigation, not after the adjudication. House Bill 297 would ensure this. House Bill 297 allows for and requires the reporting of child abuse to the appropriate military installation when the child is a military family member. In regards to what if it is a recruiter, what if it is somebody from a very small installation where there isn't a family advocacy program? Every military member has a family advocacy program that they are affiliated with. In the state of Alaska, for example, Fort Wainwright covers the entire catchment area partners with Eielson to cover the entire catchment area around the area of Fairbanks. However, if a recruiter is outside of that catchment area, they can still be have their information reported back to the closest major military installation or to the Recruiting Command's Family Advocacy Program, which is located in their region. So there's two opportunities for reporting back and coordination. The Family Advocacy Program coordinators in each installation work closely together. I spoke at length with the Family Advocacy Program coordinator from Fort Wainwright in preparation for this hearing today, and he works extremely closely with the folks at JBEAR, at Eielson, and across the nation. The DOD policy required by, under DOD policy required by federal law, each military installation and or unit with 500 or more personnel has an established Family Advocacy Program. And this is to meet the statutory obligation of Section 1787, Title 10 of the United States Code to establish this program to address prevention of and response to child abuse and neglect for military families. The Military FAF is formally created by the DOD and incorporates that prevention, education, and training, as was mentioned by the chair, to ensure that the scope of child abuse and neglect, domestic abuse, and problematic sexual behavior in children and youth are all collaborated upon in a cooperative effort. The Federal Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, or CAPTA, and its regulations delineate the FAF as a federal entity subject to the requirement to protect children from abuse or neglect. So indeed, when the state of Alaska coordinates with the family advocacy programs on each installation, they are coordinating with a federal entity that is specifically charged with protecting children. These state federal information sharing mandates direct the military services to establish memorandums of understanding with state and local child welfare services to collaborate the oversight of cases involving military families. I want to make it clear that there are many MOUs already established in the state of Alaska with local authorities, and we are appreciative of those MOUs. However, those local MOUs do not necessarily cover all of the military families living in Alaska. And as I must unfortunately state, it is difficult to maintain MOUs as military personnel change and leadership changes amongst agencies. This legislation would provide a backdrop which would support ensuring these reporting requirements without the MOU being the most up-to-date or in place. MOUs provide an additional layer on top of this legislation, which will continue to be needed. Specific state-level guidance that directs information sharing with the military will provide consistency for all branches of service and state and local agencies. 70% of our military live off post, as you have previously been told, in our communities and are likely to fall under the jurisdiction of state and local agencies. The military services have investigative, intervention, and rehabilitative support resources that can assist the county and local child welfare system, or borough and local child welfare systems, in addressing these allegations and to provide follow-up family counseling when they have knowledge of an allegation. The Family Advocacy Program is not just about what are we going to do if a service member is involved in a case of child abuse. It's about wrapping our arms around the family to provide the supportive resources and in supporting that family to ensure they get the resources that they need. The FAF personnel and DSSS can share information and planning in the management of child abuse and neglect cases involving military families. Mr. Chairman, DOD appreciates your recognition of the important relationship between the state and local child protective services and the associated military FAF offices in responding and providing support and services to address child abuse in military families. The importance and benefit of establishing this information sharing throughout the state statute serves to support ongoing collaboration. Again, this is not a military law enforcement matter. This is a victim advocacy measure to protect our most vulnerable. We are grateful for the tremendous effort that Alaska has historically given in supporting our service members and their families. And on behalf of the Department of Defense, we respectfully request a favorable report of HB 297. Mr. Chair, I apologize for the mention of counties. I understand that was incorrect. I stand for your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Perot. Any questions for Ms. Perot? Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Perot, does the Department of Defense have a process that you could explain to me that happens in other states when they get notified from the local child abuse and neglect?
Unfortunately, I'm not able to hear anyone. Can you hear anyone, Joma?
Yes, through
okay,
the chair.
So we have a, hang on, let's just take a brief at ease just real quick, make sure we get a connection. Can hear us now?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Story has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Perot, can you explain to me, maybe based on what happens in other states, the process when DOD gets a referral from Health and Social Services, and if there is a timeline that they need to start services, or is it just they need to be notified?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you very much for that question. Each state varies in how they approach this, but most states have not, at the state level, established a timeline. We've left that to the specific jurisdictions to establish a timeline in their MOUs. Generally, it is immediately upon immediately upon identification of a child abuse and neglect case that we ask the local authorities to notify our military their military partners. This ensures that we get engaged as early as possible in the child abuse and neglect potential case and provide support to those military families as soon as possible. This not only provides the benefit of having a military-focused counselor, healthcare providers, and a military family advocacy program that may have been aware, may be aware of challenges this family has had at a previous installation involved, but it also reduces the burden on local authorities as they can provide, as we can provide additional resources that, to these families that they may not have been able to receive in the community.
Follow up.
Thank
you for that. Through the chair, and obviously, with the state having authority, how do the lines of communication work so we can make sure that a child is still being protected? And I understand that there's collaboration. So what is the agreement about who's really coordinating the services, I guess I'm saying? Whose responsibility, yeah. Ultimate responsibility?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Story, that's an excellent question. And I believe that this is often determined on a case-by-case basis, but I would like to get back to you with more details on how that has worked on cases specifically in Alaska and how that has worked in other states. But my understanding is this generally is determined on a case-by-case basis, who the authority is that ends up being the lead on those in, on those cases.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Perot. Any further questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Perot, this piece of legislation, it doesn't apply to soldiers who are AGR status, not necessarily M-Day, you know, people who are part of the National Guard but are serving, you know, in that active capacity. That would not apply to them, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Nelson, thank you for that question. The National Guard and Reserve also have family advocacy programs. Obviously, this applies to our active duty soldiers within the National Guard and Reserve. So AGR soldiers also fall under family advocacy programs as well, and this would be a coordination that would be done for those folks as well.
Follow up?
So what you're saying is that even though it only says strictly active duty soldiers, that this would still under fall under the M-Day or the AGR soldiers?
Yes, those soldiers that are active Guard Reserve soldiers would be required to have that coordination for our AGR soldiers. Thank you, through the chair. Apologies.
Thank you, Ms. Perot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any further questions? I have a few questions since we're bringing up the National Guard. I know here in the state of Alaska, we had, before we updated our military code of justice, we had problems with sexual assaults. And the sexual assaults were being reported from the Department of Public Safety to the commanding officer or those in charge. And a lot of victims became re-victimized as a result of those communications. So how are we to ensure that there is a barrier, that there is a line, or that we're not re-victimizing? Now, I'm talking about sexual assaults, not necessarily child abuse, but that's one of the problems we had in rewriting the Military Code of Justice, is trying to figure out how to best handle this so that we don't fall into a situation again where favoritism was being played and victims were being re-victimized.
Chairman Tuck, thank you for bringing up that sobering and challenging information. It's not anyone, it's readily acknowledged within the Department of Defense that we have had a challenge, a problem with sexual assault. And it has been extremely difficult for us to ensure that there isn't favoritism or any type of negative consequences for those victims that come forward. This, again, is a situation where the family advocacy program is administered at a higher level than a military member's unit. And so the chain of command is separate from the family advocacy program. And the family advocacy program itself is not designed to provide any sort of legal methods to bring bear upon a military family. They are designed to provide those supportive resources. The judicial system within the military is quite separate from the family advocacy program. The family advocacy program providing those supportive services. We are asking for the state of Alaska to coordinate with the family advocacy program around those supportive services and not with the judicial or legal system within our military, within the military. So we understand that that is a concern, and we appreciate your comments on this.
Thank you, Ms. Perot. And then if you don't mind, can you share with us just some of the services, support services that can be provided?
Yeah. So, you know, I spoke through Chairman Tuck. Thank you very much for that question. I spoke to the Family Advocacy Program Coordinator this morning at Fort Wainwright, and I said, what is it that you use most often to help boost up families that are maybe seen as being challenged? And he said the first tool they start to use is a program called New Parent Support Services. New Parent Support Services sends a counselor and a nurse out to do home visits at a home and work with that family directly in their home to help identify ways to reduce stress and strain for that military family as they help manage. Additionally, we have counseling services specifically for these types of families, for these families that may be struggling through the family advocacy program. We often hear about some of the challenges folks have in accessing counseling services. The family advocacy program can help fast track some of those counseling services for our military families that are most in need. And we often just see that families are stressed because of financial situations or social situations. They're far away from their support system. They maybe don't know how to manage money well, and we may get our counselors, financial counselors involved in helping that family. If the family isn't receiving some of the support services, financial support services they need, add those on, and also ensure that that family has a emergency child care plan in the case that a child needs to be placed and the family needs to receive support from other child care.
Thank you. And then when you mentioned that the Memorandum of Understanding only covers some families, what is it about the Memorandum of Understanding that excluded families?
Yes, Chairman Tuck, thank you for that question. The memorandum of understanding is made through with specific municipalities, so there is always the chance that a municipality would not have a memorandum of understanding with the installation. So, for example, if a family was stationed at J-Bear and perhaps the family lived outside of the catchment area of Anchorage, they could potentially live in a town that doesn't have a memorandum of understanding. And so if it was a local authority that was engaged in the first response to this child abuse and neglect case, they might not know, because there's no memorandum of understanding there, that they would need to have this knowledge shared with the state of Alaska. This kind of provides that, House Bill 297 provides that overarching story to everyone that we need to share that information between the state and the Department of Defense to ensure all of our families get the services that they need. There's always that chance that a family who is on recruiting assignment or living farther away from an installation would not fall into the catchment area of an MOU.
Thank you very much, Ms. Perillo. Thank you for that explanation. Representative Nelson, did you get your question answered earlier? Okay. All right. Thank you. To your satisfaction? Okay. Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments from Ms. Perillo before we go on to our next invited testimonier? What do you say to him? Testifier. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Perillo. And then now we'll take up Jomo Stewart. Jomo, if you don't mind, please let us know your name and affiliation, and please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You can hear me?
We can.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So, yes, my name is Jomo Stewart. I'm the president and CEO of the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I don't want to belabor the testimony, as she always does. Ms. Perillo has given very good, very thorough testimony on the item before you. Simply wanted to come online and offer FEDC support for the initiative and encourage you, of course, to move it forward. So HB 297, really, as I read over it or heard about it the very first time, every so often we're struck because we hear about law proposals, draft legislation that you would have thought would have already been on book. And this is actually one of those, at least it was for me. Of the things that I heard regarding the testimony, probably the ones that were most compelling to me were the fact that, again, as Ms. Perot said, this is not a law enforcement matter, but rather this is a victim advocacy measure meant to protect our most vulnerable. Those would be our children and also spouses. But also, again, that really what we're talking about is not how we can do a pile-on regarding these issues on a law enforcement basis, but really being able to bring the most positive resources to bear for families and the people in need. Being able to make sure that we early alert so that they can fully marshal the resources that are available to the military and the DOD in support and service to these service members and their families. So again, regarding the bill itself, part of this, too, is the fact that what we're talking about is helping the military satisfy its own legal requirements relative to its service members and their families, those that are in their care. I didn't realize that they had that kind of legalized requirements of their own for the kinds of reactions they're supposed to make relative to their service members, even though they're hosted in our communities. And again, to their families. So again, not to draw it out or belabor it. Again, FEDC, though, again, we do support the military. As most of you know, the military is a large component of our economy. So even beyond, the kind of the ethical, the moral and ethical, aspects of our relationship with the military are the economic aspects. The fact that the military makes up about 10% of the statewide economy, makes up about 10% of the Anchorage economy, and makes up a full third of the economy of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. So we host a large number of service members. They are integral to our community, and we want them to be. As someone noted, as actually was noted several times, up to 70% or more of military personnel and their families, in fact, do not reside on the bases. They work on those bases, but they live among us. They are our community members, and we want them to be. And we want them to have the best quality of life and experience they could possibly have within our community and in our state. But if it is less than that, we want to be able to bring, again, marshal as much of the services as possible and bring them to bear to improve their lives and make it as good a living situation as we possibly can. So thank you very much. I would answer any questions as best I can. But again, really in very simplest terms, FPD supports this as well as other initiatives, again, that help solidify and deepen the relationship between our state and our communities and our services and our service members. They're important.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart. Has any questions for Mr. Stewart? Any comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Stewart. I don't see any. Go away. We may have one. Representative Story.
Thank you to Mr. Stewart for his testimony. I just had some other questions.
Okay, for Mr. Stewart or for anyone?
For the bill sponsor.
Okay, any questions or comments for Mr. Stewart before we let him loose? Okay, thank you, Mr. Stewart. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee. And thank you, of course, very, very much to the sponsors for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just would like in my mind to be a little more clear about how this works with the memorandum of understanding. So if we put this law into place, which sounds like a good thing because more a good support, so important for families when they're experiencing stress. Does there have to be a memorandum of understanding? So again, they know the timeline, they know who's taking care of what support or how, what is the process that would be in place?
And if I may, real quick, how it's being handled now is through memorandum of understanding. We will no longer have to do that once we pass this bill. And so if that makes any questions, and I mean, if that makes any sense here.
And through the chair for Representative Story, I would like to defer. I believe we had a representative from OCS with the Health and Social Services online, and they would certainly have far more expertise and knowledge than we would if they're available.
Yes, so we have Travis Erickson, who's Deputy Director of OCS. Mr. Erickson, did you hear the question, and are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. This is Travis Erickson.
And were you able to hear the question?
I was, and I believe that we would still consider an MOU in such a circumstance for things that are not included in the new statute. For example, access to base is something that's currently covered in our existing MOUs. We would still want to have protocols in place for how our staff could to get onto base, who they would have to contact, and have those things be streamlined. But beyond that, the information sharing would not need to be part of the MOU because that would be covered in statute.
Thank you very much. Any follow-up?
Follow-up. Thank you for being online. The question about the timing, if this goes into place through the chair, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name, who's helping us with OCS today, do you visualize this taking place once you know the family is a member of the military, and that might be one of your intake questions, I'm not sure, then is it your understanding that immediately you would now let the military base know of this family's need for support?
Yes. The way I would anticipate this working is that as soon as we became aware that it was a military member, we would follow through with alerting the proper authorities. That could occur at the intake level if the information is known at that time. If it is not known at that time, but it is discovered later in the investigation, the alert would occur at that time.
Follow-up?
Thank you. So that is not a standard question that is asked at intake if the person is a member of the military?
I do not believe that it is. There may be some questioning around that. I'm not absolutely positive if that is or not.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Erickson, while I got you on the on the line. I have a couple of questions myself. So you mentioned that having access to the base and streamlining the process. So currently with an MOU, do you have access, I assume, and what's your requirement to notify the base commander, or in this case, I think it's the Family Advocacy Program Director. What's your timeline on that currently?
We actually, I've been looking through our materials as this conversation has been unfolding, and I'm not finding any specific time frames. And so it's inferred that it would occur during the course of an investigation, but I'm not finding any specific time frames established.
And then also, Mr. Erickson, is it possible to have a copy of the MOU provided to the committee? So we just have it as an example to see what we have in there, because there might be some elements that we may want to put in statute just to make everything nice and clear, so it's so everything runs smooth from here on out.
Yes, I believe we could provide you a copy.
Okay, thank you very much. I may have another question, and maybe it's for the bill sponsor or for Ms. Perot, whoever can answer. But when we talk about the section on page 2, line 3, the designated authority. In this case, I think we have that designated authority as being the Family Advance Advocacy Program Director. Is that same for every state, or does that title change? And in this case, in Alaska, it would be the Family Advocacy Program Director.
Through the chair, this is Tanya Klukas. I will need to defer to Ms. Perot for this, as it's her area of expertise more than mine.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Perot, did you hear the question?
Chairman Tuck, yes, I did. Thank you very much for this question. In many states, they have used the term Family Advocacy Program specifically in their legislation that they have established. It is appropriate if you are aware that Family Advocacy Program is it is appropriate, the terminology that is currently used. This may be a more appropriate authority, or the current legislation may be more appropriate, because Family Advocacy could potentially change its name. So it is a federal organization. It is called FAP in all of our services at this time. But if the Family Advocacy Program name was to ever change, then it was in statute that it was the Family Advocacy Program, then we would need to go back and correct that statute. So I recommend leaving the legislation as is, or identifying in another way Family Advocacy Program or appropriate authority. I hope that provides some clarity.
Yes, thank you, Mrs. Perot. Ms. Perot, one of the things I'm concerned about is that designated authority. You have a base commander comes in, realizes he has a problem, wants to avoid going to the Family Advocacy Program and designate somebody else.
Yeah.
So I do have a concern with that. And if it's pretty much the same everywhere else, and on the argument that they may change their name, well, we may want to reconsider whether that agency is still the designated authority, because it may change their mission also for the reason of the change in name. So I just throwing that out there for something I'm looking at as concern.
Chair Tuck, I absolutely understand, and in many state statutes, it is referred to as Family Advocacy Program.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Perot. Any further questions for the bill sponsor or for their backup? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much a question, just a comment of support. I was able to meet with Ms. Perot, and I appreciated her time in helping answer all my questions. And it's kind of, in my mind, like a parallel to the conversation about tribal compacting and all these different ways that we're trying to recognize we could strengthen relationships and partnerships with the shared goal of, you know, reducing child abuse and improving family safety and overall wellness. So I think, you know, the reasons have been clearly stated here, but just, you know, more familiarity with the pressures that those families are facing, possibly a safer, more welcoming space where they feel like they could share those things. So it just seems like a lot of a benefit can come out of this policy. So I'm very supportive, and thank you for bringing it forward. And thank you for taking the time with me to answer all my questions prior to committee.
Okay, we still got public testimony to go through here real quick. So I'm going to go ahead and open it up to public testimony. There's no more questions for the bill sponsor. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and open it up for public testimony. Public testimony is open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing no one in the room that wants to testify, is there anyone online that would like to testify? Seeing no one online that wants to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. And so we're going to set this bill aside. However, we're going to take this up again in our February 24th meeting. If anybody has any amendment ideas or any ideas, please work with the bill sponsor on this in getting that crafted and getting that drafted so that we have alignment and buy-in and making sure that we have any concerns that anyone may have be addressed to make efficient use of our time and make efficient use of the bill sponsor. Any other questions or concerns? So if we can we have a amendment deadline of 4 p.m. on February 23rd, which is the day before our next hearing on this bill? That's tomorrow. Okay. Is that too soon? I know it isn't for the bill sponsor. But I'm looking at the committee members. Okay, all right, so we'll try to accommodate. All right, so our next that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting for the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs will be at 1 p.m. on Thursday, February 24th. If there's no other business, the meeting is adjourned at 2:18 p.m.